From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. This week, we welcome Peter Guralnick back to the show, the author of the definitive biography of Elvis Presley. Peter Guralnick has written outstanding fiction, as well as great books about music, including Sweet Soul Music, Rhythm and Blues, and The Southern Dream of Freedom, and Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. His new book is a biography of Sam Phillips, founder of Sun Records and the first person to record Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Johnny Cash, Charlie Rich, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins. He was also the man who unleashed Elvis Presley upon the world. The book is called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Peter Guralnick, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks. It's great to be back.
At that moment that Elvis Presley grabbed his guitar and started to sing That's All Right, Mama, the moment you described so well in Last Train to Memphis, the first volume of your Elvis Presley biography, that was actually the kind of moment that Sam Phillips orchestrated many times, right?
Well, in a way, it was a product of that almost preternatural patience that he showed in a man as his assistant, amanuensis, and person who contributed so much to the early years of Sun, Marion Kiesker, said, and a man not given to patience. He showed the most extraordinary patience, and what it was he waited for the moment to manifest itself. I mean, he was very different from a lot of contemporary producers in the sense that he wasn't looking to put his stamp on it. He wasn't looking to have this called a Sam Phillips production. I mean, the word producer didn't even exist at the time, but what he was looking to do was to have whoever he was recording, whether it was Howlin' Wolf or Charlie Rich or the Prisoners or Elvis Presley, to have their talent, you know, their inner self declare itself, and to wait until it did.
The last time you wrote about this era in your Elvis Presley books, you're like following Elvis's life through its intersection with Sam Phillips' life, and this time you're following Sam Phillips' life, which briefly intersects with Elvis. Were there things you learned from Sam Phillips about his working with Presley that you didn't know when you wrote about Elvis?
I don't think so. Not really. I think what it is that the picture is entirely different because of the angle of perception. I mean, it doesn't have to do with presenting new facts. It has to do with Elvis being a part of Sam Phillips' story in this book, whereas in Last Train to Memphis, Elvis is a part of Elvis' story. I mean, this is true of any aspect of all of our lives.
Right.
We're always a part of somebody else's story, and we always see our own story in the foreground. But in this case, Elvis is one of a procession of artists, almost every one of them prior to him, black, who were the subject of what amounted almost to a crusade on Sam Phillips' part. It was something that he had envisioned from the time he was very young. The idea that this music, basically African-American music, once a mainstream audience was exposed to it, it would conquer. It was kind of like love conquers all. In Sam's mind, music would conquer all and would break down the barriers of race. It would break down the walls of segregation. It would break down, the barriers of class. And that mainstream audience would embrace it. And in embracing it, would make a great social and racial leap forward. It didn't happen in quite that way, but that was Sam's vision, and ultimately that's what Elvis, not alone, I mean, I don't mean to say that Elvis was the person who accomplished it alone by any means. I mean, it was something that was in the air, nor did Sam Phillips accomplish it on his own in any sense, and he would be the first to say so. But they contributed enormously to that sense of forward progression and to the acceptance by a mass audience of the kind of music that had inspired Sam from childhood on, and that allowed for, with its acceptance, that allowed for people like Ray Charles, I mean, great, great, great artists like Ray Charles, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, the gates just swung open wide for them. They went from being R&B stars to becoming pop stars and to being the foundation for the music we hear today.
So Sam Phillips wanted, I mean, he had not just musical ambitions, but civil rights ambitions.
Yeah, I don't know if he would have. I mean, I think that's a fair statement. I don't think whether he would have said it quite that way. He would have accepted it though. and I mean, his first ambition was to be a criminal defense lawyer like Clarence Darrow, and he always emphasized it wasn't just a lawyer, it was a criminal defense lawyer, and it was with the idea of righting so many of the wrongs that existed in society. His first vision of race came from working in the cotton fields on the 323-acre farm that his father rented. He didn't own it, and he lost it once the Depression arrived. But working in the cotton fields with black and white sharecroppers, and coming to the realization very early on, something he articulated to his family, sometimes to their displeasure, realizing very early on the disparity, the racial disparity that existed. Why was he working in the fields? Why was he playing with? Why was he familiar with all these little black, kids, black boys and girls? And yet, at the end of the day, he went off to one school and they went off to another. And he recognized that he articulated his sense of the injustice of it just at the age of 8 or 9 or 10. But he had a sense also of, in his mind, I can't go back and find the moment in the cotton field. I wasn't there. But he said to himself, what if I had been born black? Could I have borne it? Could I have borne it with such grace? Could I have made such a creative and almost philosophical adjustment to it and created a life in a society which is so rich in cultural possibilities, which is so rich in possibilities of every kind? Now, some might say that's romanticizing it, but for Sam, he didn't know whether he could or not, and it was a question that he brought to himself many times.
I think some people might have accused him of exploiting black performers, because his first product that he produced at Sun Records, or the Memphis Recording Service, was race records or rhythm and blues records. How did he respond to that?
Well, I don't think it was ever, I don't think it was ever raised to him, but no. But I mean, the point was, he opened the studio. He opened it on January 2nd, 1950, with the expressed intention of giving the great Negro artists of the South, some of the great Negro artists of the South, and this is a term of respect, an opportunity to record where none existed. And that was his entire purpose. And the reason for doing so was because he believed so strongly in the music. He believed so strongly in the idea of racial progress. He believed so strongly that the music would create a kind of racial awareness, racial progress, by its acceptance, it would just break down people's prejudice to a considerable extent. And so he was dedicated to this idea, and it was a vision that he had almost, that which he pursued for many, many years.
We're talking with Peter Goralnik, and his new book is a biography of Sam Phillips, called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Now, Elvis Presley was the voice that he finally broke through into a white market with. Did Elvis Presley share any of that same ambition? Or Elvis, we know Elvis had an ambition to be a star, but what about the racial aspects of it?
I it's funny. You're right. Elvis was a highly ambitious person, but whether it was... I suppose you're right. I mean, he wanted to be a star, but he had a vision of embracing every type of music which he had grown to know and love, which included blues, included rhythm and blues, included gospel, included pop music. But from Sam Phillips's perspective, I mean, I don't know that Elvis ever articulated this, and Sam said about Elvis that Elvis was the least prejudiced person he had ever met. Elvis was very demonstrative in terms of his embrace of black music and black musicians at that time. He went to the WDIA Goodwill Review, for example, in 1956 and 57, when Ray Charles and B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland and Brooke Benton, they were all on the different shows, Little Junior Parker. And he had his picture taken for the mainstream papers with the commercial appeal, for the Press Scimitar, with these artists, and he spoke of his admiration for them, and an admiration was that was not bounded just by the music, but that was an admiration for them as people. And he was very out front about his embrace of African American culture, not in the sense that it might be perceived today, but in the sense of wishing to emulate and pay homage to these artists and being friendly with them, being friendly with people like Ivory Joe Hunter. So, and very publicly friendly. I mean, he was hailed in the early days of his stardom as a race hero in the black newspapers of that time, meaning that he was for the race. He was for the Negro race, as it was said then. And he did things which showed that support, or at least which the African-American newspapers took as a show of that support. And when the rumor started, and it's a rumor that has never gone away, but when the rumor started in 1957 that Elvis said that the only thing that black people were good for was to make music and shine his shoes, and it was a rumor that was situated in places that he had never been and in words that he never said. But when that rumor came out, he spoke with a reporter named Louis Robinson, who was the star reporter for Ebony, which was the African-American version of Life, and for Jet, which was sort of a pocket-sized version of that. And Louis Robinson totally refuted that rumor in the black press. And Elvis gave an interview when he was giving an interview to nobody else. No, he wasn't giving interviews to the mainstream press, to this African-American publication, which surely would not have sat well with many of his fans. And he went out of his way to not only deny the rumor, but to disprove it. And Louis Robinson went and spoke to many people in the black community who equally disputed and disproved it. So it was, from Sam's point of view, he and Elvis were on the same quest, but he said it was not something that they talked about and not something that he felt he should talk about with Elvis. But he said, hey, listen, you know, together we knocked the hell out of the color line, didn't we?
Well, this book, Peter Gromick, your new book about Sam Phillips, is different from your previous books in that a couple of things, you know, well, for one thing, as you point out in your book, that Sam Phillips lived a long life and got to be an old man, unlike Sam Cooke or Elvis Presley. But also your style of writing, you abandon hindsight in your other books, whereas in this one you are able to embrace that.
Well, I wanted to break up. Sam was the least linear person I've ever met. He was one of the most fascinating, one of the least predictable, but he was certainly the least linear, and I wanted to break up any sense of linearity. I wanted to fracture the narrative sense because I felt like it couldn't be any biography you read. I mean, if you reach a point beyond the time when the person achieves whatever it is he or she set out to achieve stardom, say, and is just riding the cusp of fame, to have an account of chronological account of, well, this year this person, you know, traveled, went to Russia, or here he or she was hailed as this or that, you know, in quotes and stuff. And there's just no, to me, there's no compelling interest in that. Basically, it's a repetition of the same old story. And yet people go on leading their lives, and they go on developing, and they become either larger or smaller persons. And just as in a novel, there's a narrative line which has to do with the inner person as opposed to the outer person. So that was really, I was interested in sort of fracturing that narrative sense, and also because I was there for the last 25 years of Sam's life. I mean, I'm not claiming I was there for every important moment or even for many important moments, but I had the opportunity. I got to know Sam quite well. I had the opportunity to observe him. I mean, it was like having a front row seat, not for every honor that he received, not for the great events of his life, not for when he put up a new radio tower, because radio was his first love, and that's what he went back to. But I was there. I've always wanted to. Every book I've written, whether it's with Sam Cooke or Elvis Presley or the books of profiles or Sweet Soul Music, or the books of profiles where I write about Charlie Rich or Waylon Jennings or Robert Pete Williams, my ambition, I'm not saying I achieve it, but my ambition, my aspiration, is to tell the story from the inside out, to tell the inner story, not to just convey a narrative of external events. And here, Sam's greatest, boast, I mean, what he liked to say was one of his greatest gifts was his ability to read people. And I wouldn't make, that boast in as large or, grandiloquent terms. But that's what the writer's job is, whether they're writing fiction or nonfiction. And so I wanted, just as Sam, in recording all these artists, wanted to look inside their soul, wanted to bring out that gift that they had within them that sometimes they didn't even know they had themselves. Well, I wanted to bring out Sam's soul to whatever extent I could. And so that was really what dictated. It was kind of like the revelation that I had when I was writing the Elvis biography. It started out as a one-volume biography. I thought it would be an elegant one-volume biography. And I hope it remained elegant, but it didn't remain brief. But I realized midway through writing the first, what turned out to be the first volume, that the story took place in two different, in two entirely different, I don't know what you'd acts. Mm-hmm. And that after Elvis's mother's death, it was as if the curtain came down, and then when the curtain came up again, it wasn't an entirely different person, but it was a different world. And with Sam, I think that more and more, as I wrote it, I came to the discovery of the voice that I wanted to find, and it was a very different voice than the voice that I had used in either the Sam Cooke or the Elvis, where what I tried to do was to rigorously suppress any first-person observations or anything that sort of took you out of the moment. Here I was in the moment, and a lot of it, and I tried to use that, too.
Well, what did Sam Phillips think of your Elvis books?
Well, I think he was, you know, he wrote me a wonderful inscription in Last Train, and he was a tremendous supporter of what I did. I think that the thing was, we really, in some of the reviews of the articles, people speak of a 25-year friendship. And this would really be exaggerating the case. I mean, I met Sam in 1979. I came to know him more and more as I was working on the Elvis. During that time period, I started trying to persuade him. His son, Knox, who was my greatest friend and Sam's greatest advocate, Knox and I were trying to persuade Sam for about 6 or 7 years to do this documentary, which I had in mind, which ultimately we did do. For Peter Jones Productions with Morgan, I worked with Morgan Neville directing, and it was. But it took 6 or 7 years to do that. So I came to know Sam quite well during that time. But as Sam said to me, he said, "You know, Knox. This is his son, Knox. He says, you know, Knox loved you from the time he first met you, but I didn't." And I mean, Sam believed in keeping his distance. One of the chapters is called, well, I forget exactly what it's called, but it says they'll push you off the cliff is the point of it. And Sam felt if you let people get too close, they would push you off the cliff, particularly in business. But he had that same suspicion of anyone coming from the outside, in a sense. And he was kind enough to say to me, well, you know, the reason I didn't love you from the start is because you had your suspicions about me, I could tell. And I'm thinking, man, I had suspicions about you. Are you kidding? You know, I was sold from the moment that you first started talking. but it was a nice way of reversing our roles. But he was very kind in terms of his praise of the Elvis. And the funny thing was, he inscribed that Last Train to Memphis for me in this beautiful, flowing hand, just wrote it out as if, you know, it were the most spontaneous thing in the world. But while I was doing the research for the biography, I found, you know, a first draft of that inscription, along with the drafts of any number of things that you would have thought were just done off the cuff, because Sam never spoke from notes. I mean, he's the only thing that he would have had in common with Donald Trump was that he had a great disdain for lack of spontaneity. But that's it. I mean, Sam was a lifelong Democrat, big D and little D, and all of his heroes were on the left side of the scale, including Fidel Castro, whom he called after the Bay of Pigs and told him to hang in there, not to be too discouraged, because he saw him as a great freedom fighter.
Did Castro know who Sam Phillips was?
Well, you see, this is the great question. Who was Sam really talking to? He spent a great deal of time on the phone talking to someone in Cuba, and he came to the conclusion that he had been speaking to. This is very late at night, and this is after Sam, on the advice of his doctor, had taken up drinking. He never took a drink until he was 32 years old, and then he said he more than made up for it. And so he had Sally Wilburn, his companion and for the last 50 years of his life, said she found the bill the next day when the telephone bill arrived, and she said, "Sam, who are you talking to?" And that was when he said, "Well, I was talking to Fidel Castro, but actually, I think I was talking to his brother Raul." That was his. But I can only testify to the intent behind the call. I can't. I wasn't on the phone at the time.
Well, one thing I learned in Sam Phillips, the man who invented rock and roll, Peter Grolnick, is the sale of Elvis's contract to RCA or to Colonel Parker, that really he didn't have a choice in the matter. If he hadn't sold it, he wouldn't have gotten anything.
No, he had no choice, most of all because he was on the verge of bankruptcy. And I had always heard that, but in looking over the documents and seeing the financial documents and seeing his correspondence at the time, I came to the realization that things were even worse than he had portrayed, you know, just in summary. And I mean, the reason that he was on the verge of bankruptcy is the same reason that that so many independent labels, so many small labels have been put out of business by a hit. I mean, in the record business, as it was anyway, and I'm sure there are parallels with many businesses and many things as they are today, but in the record business as it was, the worst thing that could happen to you is to have a hit, because that meant you had to pay all of your costs up front. You had to pay the manufacturing costs, you had to pay the pressing costs, because you wouldn't have any records if you didn't. Then, having paid the costs, the challenge was to get the money you were owed by the distributors. And the thing is, if the distributors didn't see another hit coming down the pike, if they didn't see you as producing more hits, they might hold off on paying you until they saw whether you were going to stay in business or not. So you were always behind the eight ball as far as that went. So really, when Sam sold Elvis's contract, the Sun label was a little more than 2 years old. He had had any number of hits, first with his African-American artists like Rufus Thomas, The Prisoners, Little Junior Parker, and they were good-sized hits for R&B hits, but they were that meant they sold anywhere between 35 and maybe 60 or 75,000 copies. With Elvis, that first record, That's All Right, sold over 100,000 copies, but Sam kept very meticulous records, but he couldn't keep up with the royalty payments. And he couldn't keep up with the excise tax payments. The excise tax was a holdover from the Second World War and was a 10% tax on every record you manufactured, not every record you sold. So he had meticulous records, and he persuaded the IRS to let him stay in business because he had every intent of paying, but he couldn't pay. So with the $30,000, $35,000 that he got from RCA for Elvis's contract, first of all, and the $5,000 beyond that RCA paid Elvis to take care of all back royalties, a settlement for all back royalties. With that $35,000 that Sam had, he was able to pay his bills, and he was also able to finance the record company for the first time. And the first record that he had out, or at least the first real record that he had out after Elvis, almost in the immediate aftermath of selling Elvis's contract, was Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes, and he could promote it, he could pay for advertisements, he could go on the road and sell it, I mean, not sell the records, but sell the idea. And Blue Suede Shoes was really the prototype of rock and roll, because it was the first record ever to top all three charts, top the, pop, country, and rhythm and blues charts. It was followed very shortly by Elvis's Heartbreak Hotel, but it was a time when RCA thought they had bought the wrong artist.
They bought the wrong hillbilly.
Right.
Well, it's pretty great of Sam that he made sure that Elvis got taken care of. I mean, he could have made his own deal, but then he would have had to pay Elvis. So but he took care of Elvis.
Sam was extremely conscientious in his business approach. One of the most amazing things that that I discovered, just it was really only while I was doing the copy editing on the book that all of this. The earliest correspondence, something I'd been looking for from the beginning, something that Sally Wilburn had been combing through the records to find, the earliest correspondence with the Modern label, with Jules Bahari at the Modern label, and with Leonard Chess, detailing all of his earliest ventures in record making, and in all of the correspondence there runs the thread: we have to pay the artist properly, we have to pay them for their songwriting, We have to pay them for their time. We have to make them feel a sense of, you know, their own worth. If we don't, we're just going to be creating product as opposed to the great music that they're capable of. This didn't sit that well, particularly with Jules Bihari of Modern Records in L.A., but it was a theme that Sam kept on, and it was very much, you know, it was... He was a child of the Depression. Nobody would say he was a spendthrift, and many would say he was a tightwad. But he was absolutely bent on paying not just every penny that was owed, but also behaving with, I guess, you know, a kind of, not, I don't want to call it generosity, just with a humanity towards anyone with whom he dealt.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train, train, coming down, down the line. Train, train, down the line. Well, it's bringing my baby, 'cause she's my all mine. She's my all mine. Train, train, round the bend, round the bend. Train, train, coming round, round the bend, round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again.
It's just an amazing work of art. Your new book, it's called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Peter Gralnick, the author, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks so much. I mean, I really recall enjoying it so much the last time we did it, and I enjoyed it even more this time. So thanks again.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Peter Gralnick. His new book is called Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.